Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Our guests today are experts on vegetables and seeds. Bjorn Bergman, head of marketing and communication at SeedLinked, one of our guests. Bjorn, welcome to the show.
Hey, Larry. It's so great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. Craig LaHoulier with us as well, the author of Epic Tomatoes and Growing Vegetables in Straw Bales, curator of three Tomato SeedLinked seed collection experiences. And Craig, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much, Larry. It's great to be here.
We'll start talking about the SeedLinked program, how it works, and how you can join in. Maybe you can participate. Then we'll take your questions about growing vegetables. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Bjorn, let's start with you. Tell us about what SeedLinked is all about.
Yeah, definitely. That's a great question. And when I introduce SeedLinked to new people, I kind of like to think about how everyone orders seeds in this day and age. And so I imagine that many listeners are similar to me. I get tons of seed catalogs in the mail every winter. And I know sometimes it's not the best time to plant a garden because of all the snow on the ground in Wisconsin. You start getting really big dreams and start imagining you can plant more than you can handle. But I get all these seed catalogs and I spread them out on my kitchen counter and start perusing through them. I dog ear some pages, and there's some varieties that I know I love and I'm going to grow every year. But then every year, maybe like 25% of the varieties, I'm looking for something new. I want to try out a new tomato, a new lettuce, a new pepper or cucumber. And when I go to buy that new variety, I'm looking at the pictures, the descriptions in the catalog, and kind of hoping it meets those descriptions in those pictures.
Yeah.
Not quite sure if that's going to become a reality. But kind of comparing seed purchasing to how we purchase everything in this day and age. If we want to buy like a backpack or a bike helmet or a baby seat or a dishwasher, a dryer for our clothes, we can go online and we can see reviews for those people that have used them before, have spent time and rated them and given feedback on how they perform, maybe what's good about them, what's bad. But when it comes to seed, there really isn't necessarily quite the equivalent, and that's where SeedLinked comes in, and we'd like to create the equivalent of that. And so we have an online platform. We also have a phone app. And so the idea is that we crowdsource, use community science or citizen science, whatever you want to call it, for people to share their input on how varieties perform in their gardens, and we link their profiles to their growing zone. And then when they submit those reviews, they power our Seed Explorer, where people can search for the right seed for their garden. This is kind of SeedLinked in a nutshell.
Well, that is pretty cool. So there, I think I can see that there'd be more than one thing in it for the gardener here. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, for sure. I know, like, I've been gardening for just 11 years now. I don't think I'm the most expert person out there, but I've learned a lot from reading books and from other people. And there's so many people out there that just have such immense knowledge and so much info to share, especially how varieties perform. And I think gardeners could have so much to share on SeedLinked by sharing how varieties perform in their gardens, and letting other people search that information so that they can find the right seed for them and kind of make selecting new varieties especially less of a blind spot and more of an opportunity for success and collaboration. So yeah, with SeedLinked, we're just really hoping that it's a place where all the stakeholders in the seed system, gardeners, farmers, seed companies, seed breeders can come together and have a more transparent seed system, and we can all grow better and grow more delicious food for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, Craig LaHoulier, let me turn to you. Talk about how you've been involved in SeedLinked.
Sure. Well, I met Bjorn and the other folks from SeedLinked just about a year ago, which turned out to be my last trip prior to COVID shutting everything down. And in a way, I've been looking for a system, a platform like SeedLinked for my whole 40 years of gardening life. When I wrote the book Epic Tomatoes and people started finding my email, one of the most frequently asked questions I get is, give me a list of 10 tomatoes that I should grow in my area. That is information that really is difficult to ascertain because, well, for example, our dwarf tomato breeding project, we've created 133 new babies. We've launched them out to the world, but I can't say yet which ones will thrive in Seattle, which ones will fail in Vermont, which ones will people love in North Carolina and dislike in Arizona. So I think one of the great parts about SeedLinked is I'm a big-time collaborator. I love the fact that it's collaborative. Our whole dwarf breeding project was just using the talents of volunteers all over the world, 800 people or more. And so this is what helps gardeners to become forever gardeners, success. We put a lot of work into gardening. We have hopes and dreams. We envision quarts and quarts of tomatoes and bags of beans. But nothing's more discouraging than putting a lot of work into something and then have it fail. So what something like SeedLinked will help us to do is everyone succeeds and all of these new COVID gardeners are more likely to become forever gardeners, which would be such a great thing.
So what's the experience like for gardeners who join in? What do they do?
Yeah, there's a couple of different ways that gardeners can join in. For those people that are really new to gardening, we have a great new program that we started actually in response to the COVID-19 pandemic and all those pandemic gardeners. It's called the Seed Collections Experience. And so last year, about this time, I think it's a year to the date when all the lockdowns started, pretty much, people started just buying tons of seeds. And like many of your listeners know, it's been hard to purchase seeds from some seed companies because they're just getting so much demand. And like Craig said, I love gardening. I love sharing about it. And I want to see more of those people have success. And I want to see them garden year after year. And so at SeedLinked, we were just like, what's something we can do to use our platform to help support those new gardeners? And Seed Collections Experience was born. And so we reached out to a bunch of different food system change makers, influencers, and we asked them to curate collections of seeds. And then so folks can go on our website and purchase a seed collection from one of those curators. They get the seeds in the mail. And then as part of that, they're invited to a collaborative trial on the SeedLink platform where they can share their feedback on how the varieties grow in their garden. The curator also has live check-ins with those people so throughout the growing season. So maybe at the beginning of the season, mid-season, and harvest time to answer their questions and help them be successful in growing those varieties. And then soon on the SeedLink platform, we'll have a social feed where other people in the trial can interact with each other, share photos, comments, and just learn from each other and build community through growing these varieties. And so Craig is a curator of three collections, and I'm a curator of one collection as well. So that's a great way that, beginner gardeners and even experienced gardeners can plug into SeedLinked.
Well, Craig, tell me, you're a collector. You have collections. What would one of your collections look like?
Sure. Well, so I've been gardening for 40 years. I've been the Seed Savers Exchange tomato advisor, since the late 90s. So I've amassed a collection of about maybe 4,000 or 5,000 different varieties of tomatoes. That's only about maybe a little less than half of the approximately 10 or 12,000 varieties that are out there at least, and that number is growing all the time. But I felt so gratified when SeedLink asked me to be a curator because I then got to choose some of my favorites, and there was a method to my madness for each one of my choices. For example, slicing tomatoes, Ferris wheel. It's a large pink variety that I found in the USDA collection that was first noted in an 1894 Salzer Company seed catalog.
Wow.
So that is a tomato that our great-grandparents may have grown. Our grandparents may have grown. It disappeared from catalogs because, of course, there's an element of advertising to gardening where that tends to draw gardeners to the latest and greatest and fanciest pictures, which means many, many grape varieties get left in the gutter. So I rehabilitated this variety, got into seed companies, and I would love to know, what do people think? Cherokee Chocolate, one of the varieties that arose as a mutation in my garden from Cherokee Purple. That's a tomato that I was very fortunate to have been sent in 1990 and gave it a name, and for some reason now lots of people like it. And one of our Dwarf Tomato Project varieties, Summer Sweet Gold, because being a curator has allowed me then to inject a few of our dwarfs in so that we can now start seeing how they do. We have three different cherry tomatoes. We have three different paste tomatoes. And the live chats are going to be a lot of fun. I held one last week. Mm-hmm. I sit in my yard with my phone on Instagram, and they're kind of rough and ready, but I just talk to people. I tell them the stories of the seeds and give them advice on how to start seeds, and we'll do check-ins. We'll talk about troubleshooting and planting and seed saving. This is true connection, and it's just a rare opportunity to create this community that sits everywhere.
It's wonderful. Well, Bjorn, you got to tell us about your collection then.
Definitely. My collection's called Lettuce Eat Salad, a little bit of a play on words. My wife, Heidi, and I, one of our favorite things to grow in our garden is greens, any kind of greens. And when you start, one of the beauties of being a gardener is you have access to so much more variety and diversity when you start looking in seed catalogs and trying out new things. And so with my lettuce collection, I wanted to highlight something that was an old heirloom and then also highlight some things that were new. And so the first variety that I picked is a very historic European heirloom called Forellen Schutz. It means, it's roughly translated to speckled like a trout. It's a romaine type lettuce, and it's green, and it has these beautiful maroon speckles throughout it. And it, I don't know, it's almost looks like a piece of artwork when it's growing in your garden, and you get to eat it as well, which I think is so fantastic. And so that's one variety in there. And then I picked two other varieties. I have a lettuce breeding hero. His name's Frank Morton. He has a seed company called Wild Garden Seeds, and he's been breeding lettuce in Philomath, Oregon for his whole entire career. And I think he's released well over 100 different new lettuce varieties over the course of his breeding career. And I just really admire him, because anytime I look in his seed catalog, there's always something new and beautiful and different to try. And so I picked two lettuces that are a staple in my garden from Frank. And they're red-eared butterheart. It's a butter-type lettuce, and it's dark maroon on the edges and kind of fades to lime green in the center. And then mere red oak is another one. And this is just a really different lettuce than you're likely to see. The leaves look like the leaves of an oak tree leaf almost. They have really really big margins on their leaves, and that one is also maroon as well. And so I just wanted to highlight the diversity. And with that collection, I'm just going to teach people about planting it, whether that be direct seeding or doing it in flats under lights and then planting later and then harvest. And then also I'm going to share some of my favorite recipes for salads, how I eat it. And I'm just really excited to kind of go on a journey with people with this lettuce collection, build community, and also, I don't know, just share the joy in gardening, which is the best thing.
You guys are making me hungry here. I can tell you that. This all sounds just great. How do people, I mean, where do they go? To the website to sort of get linked into this?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Our main website is seedlinked.com, and so that's linked with an ED. And then if they want to learn more about the collections, that's collections.seedlinked.com, and they can peruse. I think there's 13 total collections there. I think two of them are closed now, but there's a diversity of other things that people can choose from for seed collections experiences.
Well, I tell you what, it sounds fascinating, and we're going to talk some more about Seed Linked, of course, but also take your vegetable and gardening questions and seed questions as well as we move along today. You can join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1000. 1234. Or you can email us. The email address is ideas@WPR.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer, our on-air producer today, Laura Pavin, Christina Myshock, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at the vegetable garden today and vegetable seeds with our two guests. Bjorn Bergman is a head of marketing and communications at SeedLinked. And Craig LaHoulier is the author of Epic Tomatoes and Growing Vegetables in Straw Bales. He's a curator of three tomato seed collection experiences. Bjorn has one, has a collection of one. And this is a fascinating program to me. I really love learning about it. And I hope you do too. And if you have questions, again, you can call us at 800-642-1234, or you can email us. Send one to ideas@WPR.org. John from Madison emailed. He said he thought peppermint was a sterile hybrid species, but has actually gotten his hand on some peppermint seeds. He wants to know, how does a company do that? Do they hybridize two mints and sell the offspring seeds? Or is peppermint not as sterile as he thought?
How's Craig, your peppermint? When I think of mint, I think of plants that take over the garden and escape areas. And I've ended up mostly with spearmints in my time. But a fascinating question about peppermint that I would love to actually look that up so I can learn as well. But I don't have a specific answer for that at the moment. Bjorn?
Yeah, I don't know. I've never planted peppermint from seed before. I've always just gotten cuttings from people. And so that's a little bit outside of my knowledge. I think if we find an answer, I'd love to know. Yes. And learn about it.
Somebody will probably call in with an answer. Again, the number is 800-642-1234, or you can email at ideas@WPR.org. The answer to that or a question of your own. John in Belleville, we'll go to you. Hi, John.
Hey, morning. Thanks for taking the call, Larry, and guys, thanks for the show here. Quick question. Where I live, I don't have a big area to plant a large garden. But thinking about maybe trying to do something vertically, now with the price of lumber being the way it is skyrocketed, it's got really expensive. And so in thinking about maybe trying to stack something on top of each other, you know, create a vertical garden, is there other materials that I could use to hold the dirt in? I think treated lumber might be a bad thing because some of that stuff might leach into the dirt and into the plants. Also heard PVC might be bad because that could leach. Maybe like a terracotta, or just trying to get some ideas of something else I could use, maybe than the really expensive cedar wood planks that are out there. I mean, any thoughts would be greatly appreciated.
Okay. We probably both our guests have an answer on that. Bjorn, do you want to start with you?
Yeah, sure. I know I mainly grow in the soil in my backyard. I will admit I have a little bit of experience mostly using wood as the material for raised bed gardens. I don't know, maybe Craig, do you think maybe straw bales might be a good alternative? I guess they wouldn't be long-term necessarily, right, but they could.
Several ways to look at this. I think if you have any kind of fencing at all, if you want to avoid substances such as plastics and such, there are good selections now of fabric containers, mm-hmm. and you could attach them up the fence. One of the things about vertical gardening is really understanding the root space needs of particular crops and also what they're going to do as far as, are they going to vertically grow or are they going to weep down? So if you wanted to create a living wall for example, for tomatoes, you'd want to stick to some of the micro dwarf types that get to maybe no more than 6 or 12 inches tall. But you could certainly cascade down things like cucumbers, melons. I have a good friend, Shauna Coronado, who is an expert in vertical gardening, and she has written a number of books on it. So one of the things you might want to do is look up Shauna Coronado's books, and she will have just incredible numbers of ideas. As Bjorn noted, straw bale gardening is fantastic. You're essentially turning a straw bale into a compost bin, and I've had some of the best success gardening of my life using straw bales and also fabric grow bags. So I think you've got just an incredible amount of options out there. The tricky thing with vertical gardening, as you note, is securing the verticality of it, so to speak, and so that it stays vertical and it can handle some weight. But I would say check out Shauna's book for a zillion ideas.
Yeah. And the straw bales, I don't think I've ever had better success with tomatoes than I have with the straw bales. And disease problems are much fewer, or at least I've encountered far less problems, and get some really good crops out of the straw bales, for sure.
Yeah, so you can think of a straw bale as 2 20-gallon containers. And last year, my first garden here in Western North Carolina, I was averaging 30 to 35 pounds of tomatoes per plant, 2 plants per bale. That's 70 pounds of tomatoes from a straw bale, so you can really bump your yields up. The one caveat, just like with container gardening, is you're going to be watering a little bit more. So if you don't have a drip system set up or a drip irrigation, you will be the drip that does the irrigating. But other than that, that's a fun way to take a daily look at what's going on out there and spend lots of time just observing your plants.
Yeah, absolutely. John, thank you so much. Appreciate the call. Sandy in La Crosse, we'll go to you now. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I would like to know if there's a store in La Crosse that sells golden bantam corn seeds.
Golden bantam corn seeds. Well, that may be a problem, finding a store in La Crosse that sells it. What's the best way to search out seeds of that nature? Sandy's interested in this specific golden bantam corn seed.
Sandy, that's a great question. So Seedlinked itself, our platform, we're still developing it, and we're still adding catalogs from different companies to it. And so as we get further along with the process, my hope is that you could just go on Seedlinked and search for it and find it and then order it from that company online. But when it comes to what specific stores are going to carry, that's really kind of hard to pin down online, unfortunately. I don't have a great answer for you. I guess at this point, the best way is just to call around and ask or else search online for it.
Yeah, golden bantam is one of the great famous 1902 burpee development, 8-rode, short ear. And I think what you would do is Google golden bantam and then pick out there are just many seed companies, smaller seed companies now that have become specialties in heirloom varieties. And golden bantam is one of the classic heirloom varieties of corn. But I think that's the best way to do it. And then if you couple that with Garden Watchdog, which is a great website for then looking to see how these different seed companies get rated. So there are ways like Seedlinked is doing to be able to look at how people think about how different seed companies' accuracy is, the reliability, the germination. So lots of tools out there. Google is really a gardener's friend these days, but buyer beware. Be careful. There's a ton of information. Not all of it is correct.
Pete in thank you again, Sandy. Pete in Milwaukee, will go to you next. Hi, Pete.
Hi. I'm looking for some safe weed cover for my raised garden. The normal weed cover that I find at my normal garden store, even though I buy the 30-year, my weeds just scroll through it. And I have a neighbor who has some good stuff, but we don't really talk. So is there a safe weed cover that will be strong against weeds so they won't bust through?
And what kind of have you got just a kind of a standard garden there, Pete, that your vegetable garden?
Yeah. I mean, it's a raised garden, and probably the best thing that I've learned is putting weed cover on your raised garden. But because I have certain weeds that are in the area, it busts through the weed cover. So I'm just looking for a stronger one, but I want it to be safe on my vegetables.
Yeah. Well, You know, I've not used, typically what I've used is a mulch, and there's weeds that are going to get through the mulch for sure. Leaves I've often used, and then they're easier to pick, you know, pick the weeds after the fact.
Yeah, and maybe it's just because I'm a little bit younger and I'm okay refreshing my mulch every year. But Larry, similar to you, I mulch with just straw every year and kind of replenish it. And I know I've ripped up plenty of landscaping fabric years later that are entwined with weeds. And if someone found one that would last forever, I think they'd have quite a bit of a market for something that people would be excited about, because it just kind of seems like one of those perpetual things. Every few years, you need to go back and refresh the beds and get all the weeds.
I tell you, I've had similar experience to you. The last time I ever used one was when I had to dig one out that had, you know, dirt comes in and it fills in, and then it's a horrendous mess to get it out. Craig, what do you think?
I've used so many different things. I've gone, because of tree growth and septic location, to exclusively container and straw bale gardening. But in my typical ground gardening days, I'd use landscape fabric and had the same issue. I've used black plastic and cut slits in it for water to get through. Then I settled on things like shredded newspaper with a thick layer of straw or chopped up leaves, because you start thinking that it's great to feed that soil. And if you put something that's compostable that will keep the weeds down but also will break down over time, I then found that just replacing that wasn't so bad. And if you keep that top surface moist because of the mulch, the weeds that do come up tend to be much easier to pull because they haven't been embedded in the thick clay and with the rock. So I think, you know, there's lots of ways to skin this, but I think it's all down to moving away from the things that you haven't liked and trying some of the suggestions that we have today. But I do like the idea of feeding the soil with your mulch so that it improves it over time.
Yeah, I do as well. Pete, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Jean from Ironwood, Michigan, wonders where she can find seeds for Amish lettuces. She hasn't been able to find it anywhere, of Amish lettuce.
Yeah, that's
Bjorn, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a great question. And again, the vision for Seedlinked in the future is to be able to use our Seed Explorer to answer all your questions about where to find seeds. But like Craig said, Google is definitely your friend these days to be able to go online and search for stuff. It's incredibly useful and helpful in finding rare varieties. I guess I'd be curious to know if it was just called Amish lettuce or if there was a little bit more information, but since it was just an email, is there any more information there, Larry?
I don't have any more there. Maybe she can, it sounds like a common name to me. And so it may be difficult. Somebody else may, again, someone else may have an idea and that can call in and let us know. Again, it's 800-642-1234, but it sounds like a common name to me.
One of the things I do know is Seed Savers Exchange has a very significant lettuce collection, and they've actually loosened up the access to the collection. It used to be where you would become a listed member and pay a fee each year, but now they've gone to an online system. Mm-hmm. And so I think, but such a things like German tomato, Polish tomato, Italian tomato, Amish lettuce, many vegetable types have a name, but there may be 15 or 20 specific names under that. There's just been such a preponderance of heirloom, everything coming out these days. So, yeah, a little more information maybe if you're looking for a specific type of Amish lettuce would be great, and we could help you out.
Yeah, Seed Savers Exchange might be just a place to look anyway for some more information on that. Well, let's see. We've got Christine emailed. She wants to know how to keep rabbits, deer, and other critters from eating all of her beautiful greens. Wouldn't we all like to know that?
that's the perpetual problem. It tastes so good that other things want to get in there too and enjoy it. I know for me, I end up using, you can use small fences to keep at least the rabbits out. And in my backyard, I just have problems with rabbits. The other thing that I'll do, especially early in the season, it works really well for greens, is using a product called Row Cover. It's kind of like this white agricultural fabric. You can use like larger gauge wire and make hoops over your beds and then spread this fabric over your bed. And you can hold it down with like T-posts or soil, and it will allow the light to come through. It'll allow the moisture to come through, but it will keep out those rabbits. Mainly if it doesn't have holes in it. As it gets older, it can get a little bit holey. But look up Row Cover. It's also called AgriBond. There's a bunch of different products. You can get it in smaller sizes or big, huge rolls. And, yeah, it's funny. In my community, I just buy a big, huge roll, and there's a bunch of gardening friends that will always ask me for sheets of it throughout the growing season. But that's a good one for greens especially, to protect them from pests like that.
I think it's really a good idea. And it's not expensive.
No. I've also heard it called Remay, Frostclaw. One of the lovely things about it is it weighs nothing. And so you can cover all sorts of plants with it. And as the plants grow, they will just push it up. Other critters, such as squirrel and deer, each critter provides its own special challenge. I've used actually water-activated sprinklers to control deer. With squirrels, I've made sure they have a food and a water source, because often squirrels will go after things in the garden because they're thirsty. And if you can give them something else to keep them busy, that will make them happy. But if you've got a heavy critter infestation, a physical barrier really becomes your only solution that will work most of the time.
Judy in Stevens Point has a question, I believe. Judy, hi.
Hi there, Larry. I have planting bags that I have now used for 2 years. I can still plant in them, but they were lacking fertilizer last year. I didn't think things did as well, and I used strictly compost, and maybe not enough. And I'm talking the compost you buy at the big box stores or something like that. I wondered if your fellows had any recommendations for how to keep that viable.
Yeah, Craig, you.
Yeah, so you can have the equivalent success with containers, certainly, than you can have planted in the ground. But understanding that containers need more frequent watering, that will leach out nutrients. And so what I've gone to for a really successful growing in containers is a weekly feeding of just a low-dose, balanced type of a plant food of your choice. But I find that because I often am watering daily, in the heat of the summer, you can think of what's happening to those nutrients. And if you're just going with a compost that you're purchasing in a store for those bags, typically they're like a 0.5, 0.5, 0.5, or a 1-1-1. And that's really not quite enough to really get those plants kicking in. So you want to look more towards a 5-5-5 or something like that. And just read the plants. They will let you know if they're happy. The foliage will be nice and a deep green, lustrous color. And you'll get lots of flowering and fruit. So I think you just need to bump up the nutrition, and your success will return.
Thank you very much for that question, Judy. Appreciate it. Steve and Shano, it's your turn. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, regarding that landscaping mulch mesh, what I've used for probably 20 years now is I use a bagger on my lawnmower. And obviously I don't have a chem lawn or a thing, anything like that where I've got to worry about chemicals. But I just use the grass clippings. And if I get into, because I've always dealt with weeds, and if they get a jump on me in the spring, what I do is I put the grass clippings down pretty thick, and then it actually burns up the plants, and then I rake them out after a couple of days to a week so they don't mold or anything like that. But other than the mold, you know, if you don't if you're not careful, you do, if you put on too thick, you know, you have a mold issue with it. But if you spread them out thin enough, then it works. And then you just keep it going through the season, and then, you know, they get tilled in and disappear. So I was just wondering, is that all right to use grass clippings? It seems to work for me, but I'm wondering if it's, you know, causing any issues with chemical imbalances or anything like that.
Source of nitrogen.
Yeah, untreated grass clippings are worth their weight in gold. And I think we never had lawn treatments either. And I think a lot of our neighbors were envious because I could just bag up my clippings and my plants look great and I kept the weeds down. So there's very little better you can use for mulch than a nice layer of untreated clippings. And then you just replace them as they break down into the soil every few weeks.
And for our earlier caller who really wanted to get rid of the weeds, Barb had from Green Bay had called, couldn't hang on with us, but she said, and this is a good idea too, she actually lays cardboard down right in the rows, and the cardboard, and that breaks up over time. You put the cardboard down, you put a little mulch over the top of that, and nothing's going to... Not much is going to come through that cardboard, at least right away. It'll take a while, but then the cardboard breaks up, and it's there for your soil.
Definitely. I think that's a great idea. I've used cardboard quite a bit. We also have a coffee roaster in town, and I'll get burlap bags for free from them, and I'll do that, and I'll put either wood chips in my pathways. I'll put coffee bags and then wood chips, and then on the bed sometimes I'll put coffee bags with straw mulch on top. And like what Craig was talking about, I think anytime you can feed the soil organic matter, it just makes your soil that much more nutritious and better for plants. And so I'm all for just continually replacing mulch, and I think cardboard is another one of those great things you can use.
Newspaper is another. We've actually laid layers of paper between the rows and then covered them up in the same thing. Just breaks down. With cardboard, the only thing I'd be careful of is if it rains, it could get slippery. So if you have some areas where the mulch has thinned out, you could take a step and phew. So nobody could see my little phew there, but I tried to make the sound more reflective. But yeah, just you know, be really garden safe with things like that. But otherwise, great, great ideas.
Yeah, that old Nike swoosh.
And then laying down man. The pipe. Yes, I've done it. So.
Oh, man. Bjorn Bergman, Head of Marketing and Communications at SeedLinked, and Craig Lahoulier is the author of Epic Tomatoes and Growing Vegetables in Straw Bales, and he's a curator of three tomato SeedLink collection experiences. Been talking with them about those, and of course taking your gardening questions too at 1-800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. And when you call in, Laura Pavin is right there to answer. Take the phone call and direct you right on the air. So I hope you'll do that. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Bjorn Bergman and Craig Lahoulier. Bjorn is Head of Marketing and Communications at SeedLinked. If you want to learn more about that, SeedLinked.com is the place to go. I think we have a link to it on the Larry Mueller Show page as well. Craig Lahoulier, author of Epic Tomatoes and Growing Vegetables in Straw Bales, curator of three tomato seed-linked seed collection experiences. So great to have them with us. And callers online and a few emails. So let's go back to the phones first. And Catherine in Random Lake, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I have done straw bale gardening, and I saved my bales from last year to plant potatoes in this year. And what I was wondering is, do I have to go through the same fertilization process I did when I had them as new bales?
No. No. Once you get them started, that compost bin is forming. How is the integrity of the bales? Are they quite broken down through the use of them?
I covered them with tarp over the winter, and I haven't taken the tarp off, but they've held together. They still have their shape.
Good.
So,
yeah. Perfect. Straw bales are perfect for potatoes. And what I would do is just once you plant them, once you see the sprouts start to come through, just start a normal feeding regimen and you should have great success.
And I can tell you also that what I've done when the bales don't hold up anymore, I just take them off, put them in a big pile, and then I sort of do what Ruth Stout used to do, which is lift up a little bit, throw the seed potatoes in there, cover it back up, and there it is. And I wind up with potatoes that are pretty clean too, as a matter of fact, when you're all done with it. So that works pretty well for me, and may for you. Thank you for that question, Catherine. Well, Chris in Fort Wayne, Indiana, your turn.
Hi. Hi. Just wanted to talk a little bit about raised bed gardening. We've been at it for about 25 years. We've been using hemlock boards, which are somewhat cheaper than cedar, and they're pretty rot resistant. They'll give you about 10 to 12 years. We generally make them at 10 or 12 inches high, 2 inches thick, and then we do 4x8 consistent beds. Anyway, we got tired of replacing wood, so we just bit the bullet and bought limestone. You can get quarried limestone in a 2.25 by 10.5 inch high piece, any length you want. Again, we're doing 4x8 beds, so we got some 4-foot pieces and some 8-foot pieces, and I think we're done. those beds are just going to sit there. And they also, as the limestone degrades, there's just a little bit of alkaline material that goes in. We've got clay soil, so it's a perfect match.
Oh, well, yeah, that's probably good. They're going to probably be there long after you and I are gone, Craig, Chris. that's a good idea. There's plenty of limestone in Wisconsin, that's for sure. Thank you for that. Jill in Madison, your turn. Hi, Jill.
Hi. Thank you, Larry, for taking
sure.
my call. And so my question is that I'm in the city and I have a small garden plot that's probably about 10x4. And we've been growing tomatoes, beans, and cucumbers for a number of years. And we've tried to rotate, but there's not a lot of space there. And a couple years ago, I think we just had so much rain and we had the flooding that I got blight. So last year, I covered the soil with newspaper and cardboard and straw on top, and that seemed to help my tomatoes. And I was very careful watering, but my cucumber just never made it. It just kept dying from the wilt. So I've heard about soil solarization. Is there a way that I can, since it's such a small plot there, is there a way that I can get rid of the blight, or am I just stuck with it?
Well, you have options. there are options. Craig, do you want to throw in?
Yeah. Well, one of the first things to really try to nail down is the specific agent that's causing you problems. Because with tomatoes and cucumbers, each one of them can attract a host of diseases. Tomato diseases that bother the most people tend to be fungal, and they tend to blow either splash up from the soil or blow in from the side. So even if you were to solarize your soil, as long as Septoria leaf spot and early blight are in plants that are in your area, that will blow on, attach themselves to wet foliage. Those aren't dire like things like Fusarium or Verticillium that actually is in the soil and works itself up from the roots. And that's really, really bad for tomatoes. With cucumbers, typically the problems that are caused would be a downy mildew, which again will blow in, or cucumber beetles that bite on the plants and bring in a virus disease. And no amount of working with the soil will actually eliminate that. So some things can be done through the soil, other things, as you say, through good garden practices, but other things are going to be keeping the critters off the plants and watching for them. And cucumber spotted wilt is really bad. It does nail cucumber plants. I didn't grow my cucumbers well here in North Carolina because both downy mildew and the cucumber beetle got me. So Bjorn, Larry, anything you want to add to that?
Well, it's a 4x10, and you know, I'm thinking there could be some covers, but Bjorn, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to call the attention to how seeds can sometimes help with this as well. I know that in the tomato world, a lot of times what they're breeding for these days is resistance or tolerance of specific diseases. And so, like Craig said, if you can really nail down what you have a problem with, you can search for varieties that might be resistant to those specific things. In my experiences, maybe they're not like completely resistant. They just don't fall over as much from those problems. And that can help you still get tomatoes or still get cucumbers. I know, speaking from experience, I've always struggled with downy mildew and squash, with heirloom squash. And in the last few years, I started growing some newer varieties from Cornell that have downy mildew resistance. And I just see so much better leaf health in those plants. And so searching for seeds that have resistance to those specific problems that you're having can help you go in a good direction, especially when Craig's talking about those things that you can't really do anything about if your neighbors have the problem as well and they blow over.
Yeah, and they're going to blow over for sure. One of the things you could do in terms of identifying, now you can't do it probably right now unless at least you had some photos, but the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison, Brian Huddleston is Dr. Death, as we call him. He deals with this all the time, and he can identify, he does a really good job of identifying what's causing, you know, what diseases are involved. And so if you ever typed in the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, just type that in the search engine. You're even going to see lots of colored photos and things of that nature. But if you have photos of your own or specimens, quite often he can give you a pretty quick answer. So it's not going to may not help you right now, but unless you've got photos. Bjorn, you were going to jump in.
Yeah, I can speak to using that service. I've sent specimens in to Brian. I had a garlic disease that I had been kind of battling, and I ended up just actually mailing him some of my garlic plants, and he got right down to the matter really, really quickly. And in that instance where I sent him tissue, I think I only spent $20, but now I know what the problem is, and I know how I can begin to remedy that. So I highly recommend UW Plant Diagnostic Lab. It's a super helpful resource for everyone in Wisconsin.
Yeah. One of the things I'd like to stress here is how diseases, well, we've learned with COVID that it can mutate. Plant diseases really do the same thing. They've been around for a long time. They want to exist. And so a lot of times just when plant scientists think they've nailed down fusarium wilt or verticillium wilt, a mutation occurs, and then you get a new race. So this is always going to be a push-pull between gardeners and farmers and plant scientists, and then we throw into it the fact that the weather is not quite the same now as it may have been when we started gardening. I know that when I gardened in Raleigh 28 years ago, we had 2 days at 90 or above. Last year we had 70 of them. Increased temperature and humidity also brings on and activates different diseases that you may not have faced in the past. So I think, as Larry says, identifying what's going on in your garden beyond just saying it's a blight or a blemish is really, really important to help us understand what's going on and to be able to grow crops successfully. So I think it's a fantastic question and a really important question.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Sharon from Barwin sent us an email. Somebody had asked about gold bantam sweet corn, if I'm not mistaken. And actually, Sharon says that Jung's seed company right here in Wisconsin, Jung's has it listed in its seed catalog. So for that earlier caller, you got it right here close by, and you can get some seeds. It seeds pretty darn quickly from them, so I was glad to have that as well. And just a brief mention, again, to learn more about the Seed Linked, I want to go back to that. You've got, if people want to get involved with this and become part of this, it's the address is, online address is seedlinked.com, and linked is like L-I-N-K-E-D, seedlinked. That's a hard word to say and just pronounce it right. Seedlinked, I want to get that in there, .com. And for the other part of it, the collections, it's, is it collections at seedlinked.com?
It's collections.seedlinked.com.
Yeah. Talking with Bjorn Bergman, head of marketing and communications at Seedlinked, and Craig LaHoulier, author of Epic Tomatoes and Growing Vegetables in Straw Bales. He certainly has a connection with Seedlinked as well. He's the curator of three tomato Seedlinked seed collection experiences. Great to have them with us for Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking seeds and vegetables today with our two guests, Bjorn Bergman, head of marketing and communications for Seedlinked, and Craig LaHoulier, author, educator, gardener, and tomato lover. And tell you what, we've been having a lot of fun talking with them, and I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. What would you like to know about vegetable varieties, or have questions about tomatoes? You know, we can take a shot at almost anything vegetable-wise here on the show. Let's take a call. Aaron in Madison will go to you. Aaron, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. A long-time listener, first-time caller here. Always consider Garden Talk being kind of the gateway to the weekend, but I'm looking to, I got a few young children at home, and I was trying to start doing some gardening in the backyard, but the problem I have is I got a lot of big oak trees in the backyard, so I got a lot of shade, and it's actually the south side of the house, and it is pretty moist back there because I kind of got back behind my property. It's kind of a city owned property where they have like the water runoff area for the neighborhood, but I was just looking to see if there's any potential vegetables that could fit those conditions.
Yeah, shaded area and could be wet. Craig, what do you think? We'll start with you.
Well, I'm gonna hand it over to Bjorn in a moment to talk about greens, because that's the first thing that comes to mind. In terms of things like peppers, tomatoes, eggplant, squash, and the other typical crops you think about, they're a bit more sun-loving. But I think, and you're talking about gardening with children, I think cherry tomatoes would be great because they are the least fussy type of tomato with regards to sun. You can have 2 or 3 hours of sun and grow a cherry tomato in a container, and it will be great fun to watch it climb up, to let them harvest it. I think you probably haven't got it depends how many hours of sun you have, but things like squash, cucumbers, melons, peppers, and eggplant are definitely quite sun and heat loving. But Bjorn, what do you think about greens?
Yeah, greens are one of the best things that first came to my mind there. They're really not in the ground that long compared to some other things like melons or tomatoes. Mm-hmm. And in my experience, one place I gardened a few years ago, there was a big maple tree in the backyard, and this whole back corner, I just plant in salad mix and head lettuce and stuff like that, and had great success. So yeah, I'd recommend trying out any kinds of greens. I think would do well with low light. And if you get the kids started early, I know I have a 10-month-old at home, and he sees me eating lettuce all the time, and he'll try to put it in his mouth now. And it's a lot of fun gardening with kids. I just love kind of passing that enthusiasm and that love of gardening on. So I appreciate the caller's question because it's something that's near and dear to my heart.
I wonder if things like radishes as well, because radishes are so fast from seed that you could put the seed in the ground, watch them pop up, and then within a few weeks just pull out the little radish. So I think you're in the business of growing gardeners, which is really, really important work. And I think things that are fun, quick, and successful will really capture them, and it'll stick with them forever.
The nice thing about the lettuces and so forth, too, is the trees aren't fully leafed out. You know, you start those early and you're going to get more light than you will get in August or July right now. So I think that's good. And Bjorn, maybe one or two varieties of colorful things. You talked about them earlier, a couple of varieties that you might pass on to Aaron. That would be kind of fun for the kids.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, like I said before when I was describing my lettuce collection, gosh, there's so much out there. You can just pop open a seed catalog and almost let the kids pick what they want to grow, because that's really fun involving them in the process. But like I said earlier, some of my standbys are an old European heirloom called Forellen Shoots. It's one long word. Sometimes I call it Forellen's Shoes or something like that. It's a little shortcut, but it means speckled like a trout. It's a beautiful romaine lettuce. And then there's just tons more out there. I really like Wild Garden Seeds. Frank Morton gets tons of lettuce to choose from. So just go there and let the kids pick out what catches their eye and involve them in that process as well.
I always, Craig mentioned cherry tomatoes. I always have a straw bale with some tomatoes, and I always put the cherry tomato right by the steps up to my house from the garage, and then I just walk by and grab a couple and chomp them on the way in and the way out of the house. And it's kind of fun to have those growing close by where they're easy to nab. So there you go, cherry tomatoes, and you can try that, and you can try some of those greens, because I think you're going to have a lot of fun with your kids. I'm glad you called. Gary in Madison, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Hi. Hello. I have in the past, you know, grown beefsteak type tomatoes, and it seemed like they were very, very large. But, you know, over the past years, I'm not getting very large tomatoes. They're just kind of, you know, medium. I just remember those great big tomatoes. And if you have any suggestions on what to use or what I'm doing wrong.
Mm-hmm. It's typically a tomato size really is determined by its genetics. So if you're looking for a large fruited variety and it's not growing large, there's probably a seed issue. I've grown some of the big things like mortgage lifters or the beefsteaks, even in less than optimum conditions, and the genetics really do show. So I would check your seed source. The heirloom types, big tomatoes are what constitute the vast majority of the heirloom types, and people love those huge tomatoes. So, you know, you look for an Acres West Virginia, Andrew Rayhart's Jumbo Red, Brandywine, which most people know about, Ferris Wheel, Cherokee Purple. That's more maybe of a 12-ounce tomato, but there are some that go pound and pound and a half. One thing that could be happening is the weather may be affecting this as well, in that once the temperatures reach 90 degrees and the humidity raises, tomatoes that are a pound or more are going to really struggle setting fruit, and you could end up with really nice-looking plants but have very few tomatoes to show for it because the blossoms open, they're not happy with the conditions, and they drop off before they pollinate. So I would look at those two things, look at the varieties you're getting, and really look at those descriptions and for the one-pound minimums, and try to time it so that your plants are doing flowering before you hit the 90-degree stretches, and you'll have much more success, I think.
Thank you very much for calling. Christy from Stoughton emailed in. She wants to plant a couple of tomato plants in containers and would like to know what kind of soil to use.
Wow. The sky is the limit. What I like to use in my containers is a soilless mix, which is fluffy. It's usually a combination of a peat moss or a coir with vermiculite, perlite, shredded bark, and then mix that with a manure such as a composted cow manure, or if you've got good composted leaves. You want something that will drain well, but you also want something that will have enough moisture retention so that you're not watering it every 30 seconds. So I'll just use a commercial bagged soilless mix, mix it about a 3-to-1 ratio with a commercial bagged manure. And like I said, if you're an organic gardener, there are many options. If you're more of a conventional gardener, there are many options. That's really all you need. And then regular feeding. Usually I start feeding maybe 1 or 2 weeks after I put the plants in, and then feed weekly after that with kind of a low-dose food. Keep them watered, and things should do great. Have fun when container gardening, because you can bring your garden to wherever the sun shines best in your yard using that as a technique.
John from Madison had to ask, had this to ask. He grows strawberries, but there are some empty spaces in their beds. Are there perennials that he could put in those spaces that will survive when he mulches over them in late fall or early winter? And I'm thinking probably some room for some vegetables in there might be a possibility too. And then you wouldn't have to, you'd have new every year, but that's just what I'm thinking. But Bjorn or Craig, comments?
Yeah, I, in that sort of space, I have this green bunching onion that I just really love. It's called Wintergreen Hardy. And actually, in Wisconsin, it will overwinter. And I can look in my backyard right now, and they're actually starting to pop up, and I can get really early green onions. And so every year when I plant my new patch of Evergreen Hardy green onions, I'll just leave some in there, and they'll kind of like die back a little bit, and then they'll pop right back up in the springtime. And I kind of just have these evergreen patches of onions that I can harvest from. So that's maybe one thing that, might be able to do well in those open spaces.
And do they ever taste good? Early, you know, those first ones? Oh boy, they're good. Craig, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, walking onions are another thing that I've grown, where you plant them in the ground and they put up greens, but then they form little bulbs at the top and they bend over. So they actually behave a little bit like strawberry plants, only instead of putting out runners, they're putting out onions. And wherever they touch the ground, you produce another cluster of onions. So they're walking onions. They've been called other things, but that's what I know them as. Potato onions is another word for them. But I think be creative with space and see what you come up with. And Larry, I just wanted to mention the person who was looking for Amish lettuce. In the Seed Savers catalog is an Amish winter butterhead lettuce and an Amish deer tongue leaf lettuce. So there are two Amish lettuces in the Seed Savers collection.
Okay, very good. Let's go to Stella in Sturgeon Bay. Your turn, Stella. Hi, thanks for calling. Stella, are you there? Maybe we lost Stella in Sturgeon Bay. Well, let's see. Let's take another email then. Sue from Gleason emailed and wants to know where she should look locally for the Agribond materials we were talking about. She has not been successful at finding it in the Rhinelander area.
So, yeah, in my experience, I usually just order it via mail. And usually for, in terms of my garden tools and materials, where I find things are usually the most accessible is Johnny's Selected Seeds. They have a great assortment of different tools, and I'll just buy my Agribond or Remay from them. I live in Viroqua, and so it's a smaller town of 4,000, and I've actually never seen it offered at a garden center before. And so, like I mentioned before, that's how I'll become my neighborhood accidental retailer after I buy that big long roll. And it's a little cheaper to buy in the rolls, so maybe you can team up with some of your neighbors and friends and buy it together. But that's the best resource I can offer from personal experience is through Johnny's.
I don't know if there's Tractor Supply or some of the big farming chains out there, but I've actually purchased the floating row cover from a Tractor Supply out here in North Carolina. So,
yeah, that may well be the case. I'd be surprised if some of the catalogs don't even feature it at sort of at the end of the catalog or something, floating row covers. Go ahead, Bjorn.
The other thing that I just thought of is if you have any farming friends, if you know anyone that has vegetable farms, they most likely have some. And if they have some older stuff that they don't want to deal with anymore, they might let you have it for free as well. That's what I can see. But yeah, vegetable farmers, it's a pretty common thing for them to use for barriers from pests and whatnot. So you can also ask them where they got it.
Hallie emailed us. She's moving into an apartment for a year and wants to know what food she can grow in a small pot garden. So she's got room for some small pots. Bjorn?
Oh, I would always go to greens because they're so quick and easy. I personally would focus on salad greens because that's something that I love. But the big question is what thing would you love to have fresh from the garden? Would you like herbs, lettuce, tomatoes? You can grow pretty much anything in pots. I know Craig's a little bit more of an expert here when it comes to growing things in pots because he's done it for so many years. But am I right, Craig, that pretty much anything?
Anything. Yeah. I mean, so if you've got a small area and a finite number of pots, the first thing that comes to mind is basil. I mean, you mm-hmm. must have basil. You crave basil. The next thing would be maybe a micro-dwarf cherry tomato, something you could put in a 6-inch pot that would grow a foot tall but give you some nice tomatoes. There are some compact-growing peppers. With the smaller shaped sweet peppers, or pick your hot pepper. They are the least fussy peppers to grow at all, and we're talking the ornamental Thai types or jalapeno types. I think what you couldn't do maybe would be things like squash or melons, but you could have a 12-inch wide pot and put in 15 bean seeds, and then you could pick bush beans. So I think with that type of a garden, I would say have fun, try different things, and then each year adjust what you grow, depend on what did well and what you crave that you didn't have. And just and then you'll find yourself just with no room to walk because you're going to have so many pots out there.
And if you're ever going to grow mint, I recommend a pot.
Yes,
I agree.
If you like mint and you want to grow some mint, the pot is the place for mint.
Oh, yes.
Not out in your garden. Oh, boy. Let's see. Tim in Blue Mounds, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Great show, by the way. I have a chicken coop, so I have pine shaving bedding and, of course, chicken waste. And I've been piling that up, and I've been throwing my eggshells and vegetable waste, no meat products or anything, coffee grounds, stuff like that, in with it and trying to mulch it up. Would that make a decent, like a fertilizer mulch type of deal?
Oh, man. You're going to get rapid growth if you've got a lot of that chicken manure in there. There's a heavy nitrogen feeder for sure. But Bjorn, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it would be a great mulch and fertilizer. I know that, gosh, I wish there was an expert here to talk about mulches and fertilizers today as well, because I know that sometimes folks get a little scared of putting wood products on their gardens, thinking it's going to kind of scavenge the nitrogen. But in that case, there's so much nitrogen in the chicken manure that I think it would be a great fertilizer for your garden.
Yeah. I think the only thing to watch for is if it's really fresh chicken manure, it can really burn if you put it down near the root zones of the plant. So you'd want to let it get weathered and composted really, really well. Kind of a funny anecdote is I happen to live near someone who is a racing pigeon person, and he's been bringing me containers of racing pigeon poo, which is going to help my tomatoes grow this year. So any kind of a natural manure like that will, as Larry said, just supercharge your plants, and they'll be very, very happy.
Years ago, I rented a farmhouse, and right next to the farmhouse or near it was a place where there had been a chicken coop. And I tell you what, I planted my garden right there, and things just, it was unbelievable, the size of the plants that I got from that garden. It was really a lot of fun, actually. Well, thank you very much for that question. You know, before we get away here, I want to go back to your group, because I want to remind people about Seed Linked. And so, Bjorn, you know, just spend a minute again talking about what it is and how people can get involved.
Yeah, definitely. Seed Linked's an online platform. We also have phone apps for iPhone and Android. And what it is it allows people to rate and evaluate the varieties that they're growing in their garden. And all of those ratings power our Seed Explorer, and people can search for varieties of plants that are going to grow best in their location. And so if you create a profile, all of your reviews will link to your growing zone. And as we get more and more people using this tool, our Seed Explorer would become more powerful and more prescriptive and just help everyone that participates in gardening and farming and the seed system. And folks can get involved in a variety of ways. They can just rate their garden on our online site or through our app. They can also be part of a seed collection experience, which Craig and I are both curators of. Craig's curated a bunch of tomato collections, which are really exciting. And then I've curated a lettuce collection. And as part of those collections, they'll rate the varieties and contribute to our Seed Explorer. So over time, we're just really hopeful that Seed Linked can be kind of the go-to place to find information about seeds and find the seed that's going to make you the most successful in your garden.
And those collections, there is also the opportunity for two or three times a year to meet with the via phone or however, online, Zoom or whatever, with the collector or the person who has the collection and talk with them, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, definitely. As a person that's been asked to do a lot of gardening education, it's so hard to like teach people all they need to know about like growing tomatoes or growing lettuce in 30 minutes or an hour or something like that. With Seed Collections experience, the way that the curators check in three times a year at a minimum with the people that are growing the collections, that really helps support them and help them ask questions and help them be successful in their gardens. And so for me as an educator, I'm really excited for the opportunity because I think it's going to lead to some more successful, happier gardeners. And for me, I love gardening so much that I just want more people to do it and more people to enjoy the outdoors and eating delicious food out of their gardens.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us today. It was a lot of fun, and I really like the idea you've got going here. I think it's going to be great. Craig, Bjorn, thank you again. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank
Craig,
you.
Yes, Craig Lahoulier is author of Epic Tomatoes and Growing Vegetables in Straw Bales. And Bjorn Bergman is marketing and communications head for Seed Linked. And you can go to seedlinked.com and find out some more. Well, that's it for Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.